On this edition of Celebrating Science, Nobel laureate Dr. William D. Phillips on Keeping Time with Supercool Atoms. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation.
This evening's presentation with Nobel laureate Dr. William Phillips is called Time and Einstein in the 21st Century, the coolest stuff in the universe. So Bill Phillips received his PhD from MIT in 1976. After another 2 years there as a postdoctoral fellow, he joined the staff of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, where he is today a NIST fellow. He leads the laser cooling and trapping group in the atomic physics division at NIST Physics Laboratory. The group has developed many techniques for cooling and trapping and manipulating individual atoms that are in general use in the world around us today. Bill Phillips' group is also a part of the Joint Quantum Institute, a cooperative venture between NIST and the University of Maryland, where Phillips is also a distinguished university professor. In 1997, Dr. Phillips shared the Nobel Prize in Physics for the development of methods to cool and trap atoms with laser light. So please give a hearty round of applause to Dr. Bill Phillips.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's especially a pleasure to be here on an evening so filled with good news and celebration. And what better thing to follow such a celebration with as a lot of really good fun. And we're going to have some fun this evening. Time and Einstein in the 20th century, the coolest stuff in the universe. And I hope to convince you that it really is cool stuff. So I'm from the Joint Quantum Institute, as you've heard, the National Institute of Standards and Technology and the University of Maryland. I'm part of the Laser Cooling and Trapping Group. And here is a photograph taken a little while ago of our Laser Cooling and Trapping Group. It is a tremendous pleasure for me to work with these people who represent some of the best young scientists from the US and Canada and all over the world. And we're doing a lot of really cool stuff, and I'm going to share some of that with you today. But the story starts, as Mike alluded to, the story starts over 100 years ago. Just a few years ago, we celebrated the World Year of Physics, 2005, which was a celebration of Einstein's Annus Mirabilis of 1905, during which he brought out three new ideas, each of which in its own way changed in a fundamental manner how we think about the universe and even how we think about reality. Now, each one of these things, the photoelectric effect, Brownian motion, and special relativity, deserve their own lecture, which I'm not going to give, but I'm just going to give just a little bit of a flavor of what Einstein did in 1905. The photoelectric effect, people had known for some time that if you shine light onto a metal, some electrons would come off, you'd get an electric current. But there was no understanding of how that happened. Einstein had an incredible insight. He said, light, which for the past century we've been learning, is a wave without any question, even though Newton thought that it might be corpuscular. We now know light is a wave. He said, wait a minute, let's think about light as if it were a particle. And thinking that way, he was able to explain the photoelectric effect. Since the beginning of the 19th century, perhaps even earlier, people knew that if you looked at a drop of water with a microscope, you would see little particles of dust jiggling around. Why was this happening? Well, Einstein figured out, based on the molecular theory of matter, that the molecules of water that are jiggling around were hitting the dust particles and causing the dust particle to move in a very predictable way. And those predictions were later confirmed. And that confirmation, along with Einstein's very specific prediction, was the thing that finally convinced people that, yes, indeed, matter is made up of atoms and molecules. Now, it may be hard to imagine that less than 100 years ago, that was not an accepted fact, that atoms are made up, that atoms and molecules make up the stuff that we see. Richard Feynman, probably one of the great iconic physicists of the 20th century, said that if somehow all scientific knowledge were to be lost, and you could pass along one piece of information to future generations to help them to reconstruct scientific knowledge, that one piece of information would be that matter is made up of atoms and molecules. And in 1905, that was not a done deal, but Einstein made it so. And probably the thing for which he is most famous, but not the thing for which he got the Nobel Prize — he got the Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect — but the thing that he's most famous for is special relativity. By imagining the perfectly reasonable idea that the laws of physics don't change if you move at a constant velocity, and that by the same token, anybody measuring the speed of light in vacuum is going to get the same answer, Einstein was able to come up with a new theory that changed our very ideas of what space and time are. And let me just give you a very simple example of that. Imagine a clock, a special kind of clock, that ticks whenever a light beam bounces between two mirrors. So we have two mirrors, and a light beam bounces between them, and that's the ticking of the clock. Now, I'm sitting here in this room, and the light beam is going up and down, and that's the ticking of the clock. Now imagine someone with an identical clock who is moving along at a constant velocity, and that's represented here. Now, if the speed of light is the same for you and for me moving along, then we've both got a clock that, as far as we're concerned, is the identical clock. To me, it looks like that clock is ticking along at exactly the same rate when I'm moving as it does when I'm standing still. But what do you think it looks like? You see me moving along, and you see the light beam following a zigzag path. But the speed of light is the same for you as it is for me. So that means you think my clock is ticking slower. And if my clock is ticking slower, my time is going slower. And so time is different for me than it is for you. And that changed everything. Now, these ideas about time are something that are still with us today. We still think of time as being a very interesting and important thing at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. In fact, making clocks, which are what we use to measure time — and in fact, when asked what is time, Einstein said, time is what a clock measures. You think that sounds flip, but by taking that seriously, he came to the conclusion that time changes for a moving observer, because time is what a clock measures, and if your clock is running slow, your time is running slow. Well, making clocks, which are the standards of time, is part of our business, because the S in NIST is for standards. And throughout history, people have used clocks, and throughout history, these clocks have gotten better and better. The first clock, of course, is the rotating Earth. People saw the sun rise and set, and they ticked off days. They made sundials, and they ticked off hours. Much later, Galileo discovered that a pendulum has a period that is nearly independent of its amplitude. So this swinging pendulum became the ticker for the famous grandfather's clock. Today, many of you are wearing on your wrist a quartz watch. And inside that quartz watch is a little tuning fork-shaped quartz crystal, and the vibration of that quartz crystal is the ticker for that quartz watch. Now, throughout history, many of these clocks have been not only marvelous works of engineering, but also marvelous works of art. And here is one of my favorites. This clock, which is about 3.5 inches across, is imaginatively called H4. For the fourth timepiece made by a man named John Harrison, who set out to win the famous Longitude Prize, a prize of 20,000 pounds sterling, first offered in 1714. For anybody who could figure out how to measure your longitude on a voyage from Great Britain to the West Indies to an accuracy of 2 minutes. Now think about this, 20,000 pounds in the early 18th century. This was at a time when a very good salary was 100 pounds a year. This is a fortune. Why did the British government offer a fortune to someone who could determine the longitude? Because they were losing ships at sea because the ships did not know where they were, because they didn't know their longitude. And Harrison had the idea that was poo-pooed by many at the time, including Newton, that you could measure longitude by having a clock that you would synchronize at Greenwich at noon, and then you would take it with you wherever you went, and you would measure, you would read what time it was in Greenwich when it was noon where you were, which you saw by determining that it was the highest point of the sun. And by seeing the difference between your noon and the time in Greenwich, you could tell how far east or west you were of Greenwich. Well, Harrison won that 20,000 pound prize with time trials in 1762 and 1764, where on a 47-day voyage in 1764, his clock was accurate to 39 seconds. I'll bet every one of your quartz watches is better than that today. But all of these clocks, Harrison's clocks, your quartz watch, the grandfather's clock, even the rotation of the earth, are imperfect. The length of a pendulum may stretch or shrink, and that will change its period of oscillation. Every quartz crystal is a little different from every other quartz crystal, and it may change with heat and humidity. And even the rotation of the earth is slowed by the tides, by storms and ocean currents. The fact that the rotation of the earth is not even constant was brought home to me in a very dramatic way one day when I was visiting the U.S. Naval Observatory. And the Navy today, just like the Navy in the time of Harrison, is interested in time. And I was visiting a colleague who was going to show me his latest clocks. And in walking down the hall, I noticed a door on which it was written, Director of Earth Rotation. You wonder what happens if that guy goes on vacation. But the point is, somebody has to keep track of the fact that the Earth's rotation rate is not constant, and that's his job. And, you know, all sorts of things affect the rotation of the Earth. So there are lots of different kinds of tickers, and they are all imperfect. But the very best tickers are atoms. Atoms tick or vibrate at specific frequencies. They have specific energy levels, and the frequencies that separate those energy levels can provide a ticker for a different kind of clock, an atomic clock. And while every quartz watch is a little different, every atom of the same kind is absolutely identical. An amazing thing that we just learned in the 20th century, that all atoms of the same kind are absolutely identical. In particular, every cesium-133 atom, which is the atom that we use to define how long a second is, a certain number of vibrations of that atom add up to a second, about 9 billion. It's absolutely identical with everyone in the entire universe as far as we can tell. So that means anybody can make a clock using cesium atoms, and they can be guaranteed, if they know how to do their job as a clockmaker right, that it's going to keep the same time as everybody else's atomic clock. And these atoms are very little affected by the environment, and so these atoms make the best clocks. Well, how good are some of these clocks? If you've paid anywhere on the order of $100, even a lot less, you get a quartz watch that is good to a part in a million, or 30 seconds in a year. For $100,000, you can buy an atomic clock that's good to 10 to the minus 12, a part in a million. That's 30 seconds in a million years. You laugh, but I think that's a bargain. Really, wait a minute. You pay 1,000 times more money, you get a million times better performance. That's a bargain. Absolutely. But still, you might ask, who really needs a clock that's that good? I mean, after all, Very few of us need to know what time it is to that kind of precision. But what I would like to convince you of this evening, right now, is that in fact, every one of you does in fact need at least somebody to be using clocks that are that good. I once saw an advertisement in a magazine that said, if you are in our car and you get into trouble, relax, help is only 10,000 miles away. And the help that they're referring to is in a global positioning system, a GPS satellite. There is a constellation of satellites, 24 satellites orbiting the Earth, and each one of those satellites has on board several atomic clocks of the sort that I've been talking about. And those atomic clocks broadcast information. They are all synchronized. So you have all these satellites, and they broadcast information about what time it is. You sit here someplace on the Earth and receive those signals. Now, the satellites are all synchronized. All the clocks keep the same time. But those satellites are different distances away from you. So when you get the signal about what time it is, you see each of those satellites telling a different time because they are different distances away, and it takes a certain amount of time for the signal to get to you. Well, those satellites also know exactly where they are, and they tell you where they are, or at least they tell your GPS receiver. And from that information, you can figure out where you are anywhere on the surface of the Earth where you can see four of these satellites. And it's the atomic clocks that make those satellites work. Now, let me just take a little detour and talk about Einstein and his relationship to the global positioning system. About 10 years after his miraculous year, Einstein formulated a new theory. We now call that the theory of general relativity. It was a new theory of gravity. And at the time that Einstein came up with this theory, it was reported in the newspapers that there were only three people in the world who understood Einstein's theory. Now, one of those people was a man named Sir Arthur Eddington. And according to a story, one day, a friend comes to Eddington and says, "See here, Eddington, it says in the newspaper that only three people in the world understand Einstein's theory." And Eddington said, "Well, I don't know about that." And the friend says, "Come now, Eddington, don't be so modest." And he said, No. I was wondering who the third person might be." Today, if the engineers who designed the global positioning system had not taken into account Einstein's theory of general relativity, the global positioning system would be off by kilometers. Instead, you can use it to navigate into the driveway of your house. It is that accurate. I have a friend who went shopping at one of these giant shopping malls, went inside, shopped for a few hours, came out to find his car, and realized he had no idea where he had parked his car among the 10,000 other cars that were there. But he pulled out his handheld GPS system and walked back to his car. A theory that in 1915 was so arcane that only three people in the world understood it, today you needed to find your car in a parking lot. So talk about what investment in research can do for you. No one in 1915 imagined that one of the fruits of general relativity was going to be that the global positioning system would work. But that was indeed one of the fruits of that enterprise. Okay, so we've got these atomic clocks. What do these atomic clocks look like? Well, if you were to go to our laboratories in Boulder, Colorado, you would see an instrument that looks very much like this. Okay, maybe it doesn't have the sign on the wall, but there is this long tube, and inside that long tube, inside a vacuum chamber, inside that long tube, is something that schematically looks like this. There is a can, and inside the can is some cesium metal. You heat up the cesium metal. Now, cesium burns in air, but this is all done in a vacuum, so it's okay. And it vaporizes, and some of the cesium atoms come out a hole in the side and make a stream of atoms going along here at about 200 meters per second. Now, as we discussed, these cesium atoms can be thought of as being tiny perfect clocks. And what you want to do as an atomic clock maker is to synchronize the ticking of your own laboratory clock, which, as it turns out, is very much like a quartz watch, except a slightly better quartz crystal. You want to synchronize the ticking of that quartz watch with the ticking of the atom. And the way you do that is the same way you would synchronize the ticking of your own watch with the correct time. If you want to know what time it is, you can go on the web. I recommend www.nist.gov. And there's a button to push for the correct time. You can set your watch to that time. Now, that doesn't keep your watch running right. You have to come back later and reset your watch. And if you want to know what's happening in between, you need a long time. It doesn't do you any good if you synchronize your watch 1 minute and come back and check it the next minute. Not enough time will have elapsed for you to tell how fast or slow your watch is compared to the correct time. So I do mine every month. And I reset my watch, and I make a notation about how fast or slow it was, so that during the next month, all I have to do is to look at the date, and I can automatically correct for the time, and I always know what time it is to a second. I'm a geek, you know, that's what we do. Thank you. An audience of appreciative geeks. It's wonderful to be here. So, the same thing applies here. You synchronize the ticking of your laboratory clock here. The atoms fly to the other end of the apparatus, and there you check. And if they're not the same, then you make a correction to your laboratory clock. Now, the problem is these atoms are moving at 200 meters per second. The distance from here to here in the biggest of these clocks is only about a meter. They tried making it bigger and it didn't work very well because the atoms sort of drooped as they were going along. So these things are about a meter long in the very best of them. That means you only have a few milliseconds to make the comparison. Somebody said, this is sort of like trying to tell time with a clock that's whizzing past your face at the speed of sound and then crashing into the wall. Not such an easy thing to do, but 50 years of engineering and scientific application have made these clocks good to a part in 10 to the 14, a part in 100 million million. But they aren't getting any better than that, and the reason they're not getting any better than that is because the atoms are moving so fast, you just don't have time to make the measurement. But that's not all. That's not the only reason why the atoms moving fast gives you a problem. Another problem is the Doppler shift. If I've got anything that's putting out a signal, a wave, ticks of a clock that are being broadcast, and I've got an observer that's moving toward that clock, or if the source of the broadcasting is moving toward the observer, there will be a shift in the frequency. It will look like the frequency is higher. It's the same thing as if you were on the seashore and waves were coming in. There'd be a certain frequency at which those waves were coming. If you got into a boat and went into the waves would hit your boat more frequently. So that higher frequency is the Doppler shift for waves, for ocean waves. It happens for sound waves, it happens for light waves. And with the atoms moving around really fast, it can be a problem. By the way, this is how the cops tell how fast your car is going. They shine microwaves on your car, they bounce off your car, and if your car is moving, the frequency is shifted, and they just measure the difference in the frequency to tell how fast you're going. Well, how big of an effect is this? Well, the fractional change in the frequency is equal to the ratio of the velocity of whatever's broadcasting, let's say our atom, to the speed of light. Now, a typical atomic velocity, the velocity of the nitrogen molecules in the air in this room, is about 300 meters per second. The speed of sound is 300 million meters per second, so that means this fractional change is a part in a million. Now, a part in a million may sound small, but we're trying to make clocks that are good to a part in 10 to the 14. So this is a disaster. And clever people, over the course of 50 years, have come up with all sorts of neat tricks to get rid of this. And the degree to which those tricks just don't quite work perfectly is one of the main things that limits the ability of these clocks to get any better. But that's not all. Einstein again. Einstein told us that moving clocks run slow. Well, these atoms are moving. How big is this? Well, it goes like the square of the ratio of the velocity of the clock to the velocity of light. And that's on the order of a part in 10 to the 12. Well, that sounds pretty small, but we're trying to do better than a part in 10 to the 14. So it's not so good, and there's no tricks to fix this. You have to measure the velocity of your atoms and make a correction. And the degree to which that can be done is the thing that limits the accuracy of those kind of clocks to about a part in 10 to the 14. So there's only one thing to do, and that thing is to reduce the velocity of the atoms. And reducing the velocity of the atoms means making things colder. Because the difference between hot and cold is the difference between fast and slow. If I've got a gas of atoms and it's hot, like the air in this room, which feels kind of hot to me right now, it means that the atoms and molecules in the air are moving fast. 300 meters per second, the speed of sound for the nitrogen molecules in the air in this room. If I could cool down the gas molecules, then that would mean that the molecules or the atoms in the air would be moving more slowly. Now, to give you an idea of what we're talking about, I've got here, in a number of containers, some liquid nitrogen. I mean, nitrogen is the major constituent of the air, and so this stuff is basically liquid air. This stuff is so cold that compared to it, the floor on which I am standing is as if it were burning hot. What would happen if you took some cold water and poured it onto a red-hot stove? Well, you know, it would boil, and that's what happens when I do that with the liquid nitrogen. It boils when I pour it onto the floor. Well, if you've got something that's that cold, so cold that it would boil when you pour it out on the floor, well, it seems like it would be a good idea to cool down a gas by refrigerating it with something that cold. Well, here I have a traditional container for hot gas. And here I have a bait bucket that is filled with liquid nitrogen, or at least it was filled with liquid nitrogen before all the celebrations started. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put the balloon into the bait bucket full of liquid nitrogen to cool down the gas so as to make the molecules and the atoms go more slowly. That's what we want to do. Now, let me give you some idea about how cold this stuff is. Here's a styrofoam cup. It's warm. It's been sitting out in the room all day. Compared to it, the liquid nitrogen is incredibly cold. Imagine that you took a steel bucket and heated it up until it was red hot and then poured cold water into it. What would happen? Well, okay, great. Don't try this at home. Now, that's boiling away. So while it's boiling away, let's cooling down the inside of the cup, let's cool down some more gas. Okay, tie that off. What? Okay, now, the liquid nitrogen boiling has subsided, so what that means is that the inside of the cup is now down to the temperature of liquid nitrogen. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this carnation, nice, fresh carnation, room temperature. It's really hot. Imagine taking a fireplace poker and heating it up until it was red hot and then plunging it into a bucket of cold water. What would happen? Well, the water would boil, and that's what happens when I do this. The water boils. So let me just let that sit there, boiling away, cooling down the flour to the temperature of liquid nitrogen. And let's cool down some more gas. There's no lack of it. I come from Washington, D.C. Hot air is in. Okay. So now let's put another another balloon in here. Okay. Now, how cold is this stuff? Here, nice stretchy rubber band. So I'm going to take the rubber band and dunk it into some liquid nitrogen. Now, of course, it makes the nitrogen boil, because that's what always happens when you dunk anything that's warm into liquid nitrogen. But when I take it out, it is frozen so hard that I can break it like it was a dry twig. But all I have to do is warm it up in my hands a little bit, and it's nice and stretchy again. This stuff is really, really cold. And if you've got something that's that cold, well, why not use it to cool down your gas? To make the atoms and molecules move more slowly so that we can make better measurements on them. So let's cool down some more gas. Okay, now let's see what else we can do. A racquetball. Nice bouncy racquetball. Almost lost it in the lights. Let's take the racquetball and dunk it into the liquid nitrogen. In the meantime, let's have a look at our carnation. The carnation, the boiling has subsided, so now the carnation is down to the temperature of the liquid nitrogen. It is frozen so hard that when I pull it out, I can crush it like it was made out of glass. This stuff is incredibly cold. Oh, I almost forgot. Here, a soda bottle, plastic soda bottle. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to take some of this liquid nitrogen. I'm going to put this funnel into the soda bottle. I'm going to take some liquid nitrogen and pour it into the soda bottle. Okay, good. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the lid to the soda bottle and put it on really, really tight. And then I'm going to put the soda bottle here on the floor. Now remember, the floor is like an oven, right? Well, the whole room is like an oven. Now what do you think would happen if you took a container of liquid, of water, and sealed it really, really well, and then put it in an oven? Well, we're going to find out. Let's see how our racquetball is doing. So you remember how nice and bouncy the racquetball was. Now I'm going to bounce it one more time on this concrete block. It breaks like it was made out of China. This stuff is really, really cold. And it's pretty obvious that if you've got something that cold and you want to cool down a gas, well then why not use it why not use it to cool down your gas so that you can slow down the atoms and molecules and make a better and make better measurements. So there we go. Now let's talk about just how cold this stuff is. Physicists like to measure temperatures up from the coldest temperature that there can possibly be. Now, why is there a coldest temperature that there can possibly be? Well, look at this. Hot means fast, cold means slow. What's the slowest you can go? Stopped. Okay? So if the slowest you can go is stopped, then there is a coldest temperature, because there's a slowest you can go, that's stopped, and there's a coldest temperature, and that's when the atoms and molecules stop moving. Now there's a little detail having to do with quantum mechanics, one of the key areas of study of the Perimeter Institute, that tells us that the motion is never going to stop, but let's forget about that for the moment. And just between friends, let's say that the lowest temperature is when the motion stops. That's what we call absolute zero. Now, Measuring up from absolute zero in Celsius degrees, room temperature is about 300 degrees above absolute zero. Ice melts at about 273 degrees above absolute zero. Dry ice is about 295 degrees above absolute zero. And the coldest temperature that anybody has ever measured for an air temperature on the surface of the Earth, someplace in Antarctica during the winter, was 185 degrees above absolute zero. This stuff, liquid nitrogen, which boils when you pour it out on the ground, you know, it makes a great sound on the floor. This stuff, which boils when it hits the floor, is 77 degrees above absolute zero. 77 degrees above absolute zero. That's one quarter of room temperature. The velocity of atoms moving at one quarter of room temperature is going to be about half as fast as at room temperature. So that means that when I get another bucket of liquid nitrogen, it's good that this, whoa! Whoops! That lid seems to be stuck. So let's see if we got them. Yeah, this one's good. So 77 degrees above absolute zero. When I pour this stuff out on the floor, and the liquid nitrogen evaporates, the nitrogen gas that is evaporating off of these things is going half as fast as the nitrogen molecules in the air in the room. So that's a significant reduction in the velocity. So it seems like a pretty good idea. If you want to reduce the velocity of the atoms, you could gain a factor of two, then cool it off. But the more astute among you have noticed that the volume of the balloons that I put into this bucket exceeded the volume of the bucket. Why did that happen? It happened because these balloons are as flat as pancakes. These things are little frisbees. Does anybody know how many balloons I put in? How many? Five? How many pink balloons did I put in? Oh, that one's going to be fun because it's got nitrogen in it. That one's going to blow up. Some of the other ones will too. So you see, you can put balloons in here until the cows come home. There's just... Oh, fantastic. Oh. This is great. Ah. But you'll notice the air... Whoa, fantastic. This is so much fun. This is why we do physics, because it's so much fun. The air did not go out of these balloons. The air condensed. And what happens is, no matter what kind of a gas you have, if you put it into a container and cool the container down, then what's going to happen is the gas is going to condense into a liquid or a solid, or it will stick to the walls of the container and you will not have a gas anymore. And we want to have a gas to make our atomic clocks because we want the atoms not to be stuck onto other atoms or onto some surface. We want the atoms to be floating freely in space. Then they'll have this perfect, pristine ticking frequency that is the same for every atom of the same kind everywhere in the universe. So the question is, how are we going to do that? How are we going to cool down our atoms to a really cold temperature? And liquid nitrogen, unless you work in a low-temperature physics lab, I'm pretty sure this is the coldest stuff you've ever seen. How are we going to cool our gases down to temperatures like that and not have them condense? How are we going to cool them down without touching the gas so that it would stick to the surface and condense? But there's more. Remember, the temperature of the liquid nitrogen is 77 degrees, about four times closer to absolute zero than room temperature, which means that the velocity of the atoms is half as fast. Half as fast isn't bad. But you know what? I've been working on this for 30 years now, and I have not devoted 30 years of my life to make half-fast atoms. I wanted to make atoms that are really, really cold. And how to do that, in a certain sense, has been staring at us from the heavens for centuries. Because since the time of Kepler, people have known that the tails of comets point away from the sun. So if you have a comet coming in from somewhere out in the Oort cloud, and it comes in toward the sun, the tail streams behind it. And as the comet goes around the sun and goes back out, the tail streams in front of it. We now understand why. The comet is made up of dust and frozen gas. The sunlight heats it up, and the force of the sunlight pushes the dust and gas out to make it into a tail. The solar wind also contributes, but the point is, light pushes on stuff. And what we're going to do in order to slow down our atoms is we are going to push on the atoms with light to make them slow down. Now, to understand how that works, I need to tell you about two things. The first one is resonance. In order to exert a force on an atom, the light has to be absorbed. And the light will only be absorbed when the frequency of the light, which is to say the color of the light, perfectly matches the frequency at which the atom likes to absorb. There's a difference in energy levels that corresponds to a certain frequency. When the light frequency matches that frequency, then the light will be absorbed, and then you will get a force on the atoms. Well, the range of frequencies over which this can happen is extremely narrow. For visible light, the frequency is a little bit less than 10 to the 15 cycles per second. And the range over which it'll work, the range over which the light will be absorbed, is only 10 to the 7th cycles per second. So that means that you've got to get the right frequency, has to be right to a part in 100 million. A part in 10 to the 8th, a part in 100 million, you would never be able to see the change in the color of something that changed by a part in 10 to the 8th. But the atoms can see it because they are so exquisitely sensitive to color. That's one thing. You have to be on resonance. The other thing is the Doppler shift. We already talked about the Doppler shift. If you're moving with respect to some wave, or the source of that wave is moving with respect to you, the frequency is going to be different. For any ordinary velocities, that change in the color of light is minuscule. Let's say that you got stopped for going through a red light. It would be a really bad idea to explain to the officer that because of your velocity toward the red light, it looked like it was green. Because the velocity would have to be somewhere near the velocity of light, and I'm guessing the speeding violation would be worse than the red light violation. But atoms are so sensitive that they can see those changes in the color. So now we've got the ingredients that we need to understand how we're going to cool atoms down using lasers. So imagine that I've got a gas of atoms represented here in one dimension. Some of the atoms are going to the right, some are going to the left. And I shine laser light onto those atoms. And the laser light is tuned so that its frequency is a little bit below the resonant frequency of the atoms, so that when the atoms are at rest, they won't absorb it very much. But imagine this atom moving like this toward this laser beam. It sees the Doppler shift, thinks the frequency is closer to the frequency it wants to absorb. It absorbs the light, and it slows down. This atom, on the other hand, going the other way, looks back at the light and says, oh, I'm moving away, so the frequency is lower, and it was already too low, so I'm not going to absorb very much. You see, if I do absorb light, it'll speed me up. But I don't do that very much because the frequency looks wrong. So this atom slows down a lot, and this atom goes on its merry way. Now all you have to do is to bring in light from the other side of exactly the same frequency, and now this atom sees this laser beam as having the right frequency, and it slows down. This atom sees this laser beam as having the right frequency, and it slows down, and the atoms slow down no matter which way they're going. Now you can bring in lasers from top and bottom and backwards and forwards, and now no matter which way the atom goes, It always sees that those laser beams that are pointing in the direction opposite from the way it's moving are the ones that have the right frequency to be absorbed. It will preferentially absorb them, and it will slow down. The atom feels as if it is in a viscous fluid. If you were in a swimming pool full of molasses, then if you tried to move, you would immediately feel a force that was opposing your motion, no matter which way you moved. That's the way the atoms feel. And as a result, when Steve Chu and his colleagues at Bell Labs first did this in 1985, they called it optical molasses. And the name sort of stuck. But that's not the whole story. Because if that was all there was, just a friction force, then the atoms would come to rest. But the atoms don't come to rest, and the reason they don't is because of something that Einstein taught us in 1905, which was that we should think about light not just as a wave, but also as a particle. And so imagine I'm an atom, happen to be at rest. There's light beams coming from both sides. I'm going to absorb light, but I'm going to absorb it one particle of light at a time, one photon at a time. And that means I'm either going to absorb it from that side or from that side. And it's going to be random which side I absorb it from. So let's say I absorb light from that side. Now I get a kick. Now if I'm a sodium atom, which is the first atoms we used in these experiments, I'm moving at about 3 centimeters per second. But I'm excited, can't you tell? And I want to get rid of the extra energy that my electron took on when it absorbed the photon, and I do that by emitting a photon, but the direction I emit the photon is random. So maybe it goes that way, and then I get a kick backwards, just like shooting off a rifle. You get a recoil. Now I'm ready to absorb again, but it may be random. I may absorb from that side, and I'll get a kick in this direction, and then when I emit, maybe I'll emit that way, and I'll get a kick in the forward direction. So every time I absorb and emit a photon, I get a random kick. And the atom does this kind of random dance, and that heats the atom up. Now, if it starts going off in one direction, the Doppler shift guarantees that it'll be slowed down. So there's a balance between the cooling due to the Doppler shift and the heating due to the particle nature of the light, and that balances at some temperature. And you can calculate what the temperature is. And if you do everything just right for sodium atoms, you can calculate that you can get down to a temperature as cold as 240 microdegrees above absolute zero. Now think about that, 240 microdegrees above absolute zero. This stuff, which boils when you pour it out on the ground, is 77 degrees above absolute zero. 77 degrees. Oh, we're out. What a shame. Fortunately, I've got more. 77 degrees above absolute zero boils when you pour it out on the ground. The coldest stuff most of you have ever seen, we're talking about getting 300,000 times colder than that. That got people excited. The velocity of these atoms would be 30 centimeters per second. The velocity of sodium atoms that you see in streetlights, it's about 1,000 meters per second. So this is huge. People got really excited. We started to work on this, and a few years later, we were able to cool down our atoms. So this is a picture from our laboratory that shows laser beams coming in, crossing here. This is a blob of atoms about a centimeter across with about 100 million atoms in it, and what you want to do is measure the temperature. Now, how do you measure the temperature of something that is supposed to be as cold as 240 millionths of a degree above absolute zero? You don't just stick a thermometer up, it's, you know. So how do you do it? What you do is you go back to the basic idea of what it means to be hot and cold, which is how fast the atoms are going. So this is what was done by Steve Chu and his colleagues when they first made optical molasses. They had the optical molasses on, the laser beams are on, the atoms are in here, they're jiggling around, but they're not going very far because of the stickiness of the molasses. Then you turn the laser beams off. The stickiness is gone. Whatever velocities the atoms have, they fly apart with those velocities. The hotter the gas is, the faster it expands. After a few milliseconds, you turn the laser beams back on. All the atoms that are in the intersection region of those laser beams are stuck again, and you measure how many atoms are left compared to how many atoms you started with, and that ratio, if you calculate everything out, can tell you what the temperature is. And lo and behold, the temperature that they measured was 240 microdegrees, with a big uncertainty, because this is a hard experiment to do. We made exactly the same measurements a little bit later and got 240 microkelvin. So everybody is happy. I mean, think how great this is. You do a calculation, it says that the coldest temperature you're going to get is 240 microkelvin. You do the experiment the first time, and you get 240 microkelvin. Fantastic. So everybody's happy. Other measurements on other atoms seem to confirm the same sort of thing until we started to do some more careful experiments in the laboratory. We wanted to measure how sticky the molasses was, and it wasn't behaving the way the theory said it should at all. And so finally we said, maybe we're not understanding this very well. We tried all kinds of variations on the theory. Nothing helped. And we said, let's remeasure the temperature very carefully. So we went back and remeasured the temperature very carefully. And lo and behold, when we measured it really carefully, we discovered that the temperatures could be much lower than had been predicted. Not just a little bit lower. In the first experiments, it was 6 times lower than what the theory said was possible. Now think about this. The whole idea of the experiment was to get the atoms as cold as you could. And we had gotten them colder than you could. Well, this clearly was a violation of Murphy's Law. And we felt an awful lot like the poor devils in this cartoon, who have seen something that is clearly way, way colder than it is supposed to be for the environment that they're in. So we repeated the experiment, and we got the same answer. Other people repeated the experiment. We became convinced that there was nothing wrong with the experiments. What was needed was a new theory of laser cooling. And so a lot of heated discussions about the nature of the theory ensued. And eventually, a new theory came out. And guided by that new theory, by 1995, we had cooled cesium atoms down to a temperature of 700 nanokelvin, 700 billionths of a degree above absolute zero. This stuff, which boils when you pour it out on the floor, is 77 degrees above absolute zero. We're talking about getting something 100 million times colder than liquid nitrogen. 100 million times colder than liquid nitrogen. If you go to the outer reaches of outer space, space is bathed in the afterglow of the Big Bang at a temperature a little bit less than 3 degrees. It's the coldest natural temperature you'd expect to find in the universe. 3 degrees, about 2.7 degrees. We are 4 million times colder than that. So unless there are some extraterrestrial laser coolers someplace who are getting even colder temperatures, this, at least at the time that we got that, was the coldest temperature that had ever been achieved anywhere in the universe. The velocity of the atoms at that temperature is less than a centimeter per second. Less than a centimeter per second. None of this, oh, that one's empty. None of this 77 degrees with half-fast atoms. We're talking about, instead of 150 meters per second for the nitrogen molecules that come off, that are boiling off here, we're talking about 1 centimeter per second. What kind of a clock can we make with atoms that are 1 centimeter per second? Well, look at this. This to remind you of how the clocks worked. We had a beam of cesium atoms going at about 200 meters per second. We synchronized the ticking of the cesium atoms and the ticking of the quartz clock here. We compare here, and the problem we were having was the time between synchronization and comparison was so short, it was really giving us a problem, plus all the other difficulties with having high velocities. So now the question is, what will happen if we introduce into this clock atoms that are not moving at 200 meters per second, but atoms that are moving only at 1 centimeter per second? What kind of a clock can we make with those kind of atoms? And the answer is no clock at all, because the atoms fall like stones. You see, if you've got something that is moving at a centimeter per second, it's just going straight down. At ordinary velocities, you never worry about gravity for atoms. But when they're moving in a centimeter per second, it's all about gravity. But fortunately, about 50 years ago, a guy named Gerald Zacharias at MIT had figured out exactly what to do. What he said was, forget about this horizontal atomic beam. Make it vertical. Shoot your atoms up, When they come back down, then you can measure them on the way up. You can synchronize on the way down, or synchronize on the way up, measure on the way down. And if you toss them up 1 meter, they come back down after about a second. So instead of having a few milliseconds of time with the old atomic clock with the fast beam, by tossing the atoms up and having them come back down, we get a full second of observation time. And that's exactly what we have done. This is a picture of a clock made by these two researchers, Don Meekhoff and Steve Jeffords. And what they do is they cool the atoms here and they toss them up in the vacuum. They come back down after a second. And this clock, and clocks like it in laboratories all over the world, in Canada, in France, in Germany, and in the UK, these clocks are now the most accurate primary frequency standards ever made. The one that we have in Boulder is good to 4 parts in 10^16. That's 1 second in 80 million years, and it's getting better all the time. My friends, this is what we like to call close enough for government work. I thank you, and the taxpayers of the United States thank you. Okay, so these low temperatures that we get with laser cooling have been fantastic for atomic clocks, and now laser-cooled atomic clocks keep time not just for nations like the US and Canada, but for the entire world. The definition of time and the time that's broadcast to the whole world is based on laser-cooled atomic clocks. But it brings us into contact with another amazing prediction of Einstein. In around 1924, Einstein predicted that if you had a gas of atoms of a particular kind, bosons, there's really only two kinds of things in the universe. Bosons, which are friendly, and fermions, which are loners. You know, fermions are electrons. You have the Pauli exclusion principle. They don't want to be in the same state. Bosons are like photons. They love to be in the same state. That's why I can make a laser. All the photons coming out of this laser are in exactly the same state. Sodium atoms and rubidium atoms are also bosons, and what Einstein said was, if you had a gas of that kind of particle, of bosons, and if you got the gas cold enough and dense enough, something magical would happen. A large fraction of the atoms in the gas would stop moving. Now, of course, that's wonderful. What we want with cooling is to make the motion less and less, and what Einstein said was, there would be a phase transition, sort of like going from gas to liquid. But the phase transition would be from one kind of a gas to another kind of a gas where the atoms weren't moving. Now, this is 1924, just before Heisenberg. So Einstein didn't know about the fact that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle was going to keep the atoms from coming to rest. And when he did know, he didn't much like it. But as Mike pointed out in his remarks, Einstein was never comfortable with quantum mechanics. But today we understand that quantum mechanically, the atoms will come to the lowest possible state of motion that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle allows. Now, how cold and how dense do you have to be? Well, atoms, like photons, are both waves and particles. This was something that was discovered just about the time that Einstein was doing this work by a guy named Louis de Broglie, and he figured out that things that we normally think of as being particles also behave like waves, just as Einstein figured out that things we normally think of as being waves, namely light, also behave as particles. And even though this wasn't the way Einstein thought about it, you can figure out what the density and temperature has to be in the following way. When atoms are hot, which means they're going fast, their wavelength is very short, because the wavelength is proportional to the inverse of their velocity. And if the gas is dilute, then it means the distance between the atoms is much bigger than the size of this wavelength. But when you cool the atoms down, the wavelength gets bigger. And if the atoms get more dense, then the distance between the atoms starts to become comparable to the wavelength. When that happens to the atoms get very confused. Because remember, all the atoms are absolutely identical. They're only localized to within their wavelength, and if that overlaps with another atom, they undergo a kind of quantum identity crisis. They can't distinguish themselves from their neighbors, and their response to this quantum identity crisis is to have a lot of them go into the lowest possible energy state. Now, the problem is that that it's not easy to get that cold and that dense. Laser cooling is a good start, but it doesn't get cold or dense enough. To get colder and denser, we have to use a new technique. Well, it's actually a very old technique called evaporative cooling. Now, you know how that works. If your coffee is too hot, you blow on it. What's happening is that the water molecules in the coffee that are the most energetic are the ones that escape and evaporate. That means that what's left behind has a lower average energy and therefore is colder. So what we're going to do is exactly the same thing. We're going to hold our atoms in some kind of a container, and then we are going to allow the most energetic of the atoms to escape. The problem is, what kind of a container can we use? Because you already saw that if the container is cold, the gas will condense, and you won't have a gas anymore. So if this were my container for atoms and it was cold, and I had a gas of atoms in there, they would just stick, and you wouldn't have a gas anymore. On the other hand, if the container is hot, then that means the atoms and molecules inside the container are jiggling around, and that jiggling is going to heat up the atom. You're going to lose your cold gas. So you can't use a container like that. Let's go to the document camera. So we're going to use instead a magnetic bottle. Now, I hope that when all of you were kids, I hope you played with magnets. I still love to play with magnets. Do you remember the first time you held two magnets in your hand and you brought them together and you could feel that they were being forced apart without you touching them? Isn't that an amazing thing? I'm still amazed by that. So you can arrange magnets so that one magnet will push on another magnet without touching it. So this is how we're going to make a magnetic bottle. We're going to use magnetic fields to act on our atoms, which are like little tiny magnets. Another thing you might have done when you were kids, if you had enough magnets, is you might have tried to arrange some magnets on a table so that they were pointing in such a way that they would force another magnet up, and you try to make that other magnet float on top of the other magnets that are on the table. Well, I've done exactly that. Here I've got a big magnet, and here I've got a little magnet. Now, the little magnet represents our atom, because our atoms are like little magnets. And this big magnet is pushing up on the little magnet. In fact, I can feel it in my fingers. So that when I hold this magnet right here and let go of it, it ought to float. And when I let go of it, what happens is it flips over and it gets attracted to the big magnet instead of being repelled. And if you ever tried it with ordinary magnets when you were a kid, that's what always happens. But there is something else you learned when you were kids, and that is that if you spin a top, it doesn't fall over. So what I'm going to do is spin this magnet, and it turns out our atoms are in fact like little tiny spinning magnets, and I'm going to raise this to just the place where it should float, and sure enough, it floats. Well, that's the toy version. Now let's look at the real version. So let's go to the DVD player. Okay, so here is the real thing. This is Trapped Atoms. Play. About 2 millimeters across, that has been released into a magnetic trap similar to the one that I just demonstrated in the toy version. The cesium atoms have a temperature of about 1 microkelvin, and they're being held in this magnetic trap, and they're bouncing back and forth because they were released a little bit off center. Now here's a new cloud of atoms, and you see as time goes on, the cloud gets dimmer, and that's because the vacuum is not perfect. So some of the background gas atoms, which are moving really fast, hit our cold cesium atoms and knock them out of the trap. So using this idea of holding atoms in magnetic trap and then allowing the most energetic of the atoms to escape, we can reduce the temperature of the gas at the same time that the density goes up, which is just what Einstein told us we needed to do. And in 1995, 70 years after Einstein's prediction, teams of scientists in our laboratories at NIST in Boulder, Colorado, and also at MIT in Cambridge, achieved Bose-Einstein condensation in a super cold gas, and they opened up a whole new area of research. This got those guys the Nobel Prize for 2001, and they have gotten down to temperatures less than 1/1,000,000th of a degree above absolute zero. I mean, 1/1,000,000th of a degree above absolute zero. This stuff, 77 degrees. 77 degrees above absolute zero, it boils. That's how cold this stuff is. Look at how great this stuff is. 77 degrees, we're talking about getting over 100 billion times colder than that. Using evaporative cooling and approaching and finally achieving Bose-Einstein condensation. So here are the heroes who did that. This was done in Eric Cornell's lab, collaborating with Carl Wieman, and then at MIT, Wolfgang Ketterle. And this is a progression of pictures of the velocity distribution of those gases as they approach Bose-Einstein condensation. At a temperature of 400 nanodegrees, it's an ordinary gas. It's got a broad distribution of velocity. So this is velocity in the x and y direction, and the height is how many atoms have that velocity. And this is just like any ordinary gas, except it's at 400 nanokelvin, but that's still too hot. But by the time they got down to 200 nanokelvin, this big spike appears. That's the atoms that are going as slowly as quantum mechanics allows them to go. They satisfy the uncertainty principle. And you still have the broad background, and as the temperature is brought even lower, that broad background practically disappears, so that at 50 nanokelvin, it looks like it's just a pure gas of atoms in the lowest possible energy state. Well, here is a sort of summary of where we've been on this odyssey, this adventure of trying to get to lower and lower temperatures. This is a logarithmic thermometer. So what that means is that every tick mark on the thermometer is a factor of 10 in temperature. Up near the top, we have the surface of the sun. Hardly the hottest temperature around, but a pretty hot temperature just the same. Just a little bit cooler than the surface of the sun is room temperature at 300 Kelvin. And just a little cooler than that is liquid nitrogen, this marvelous stuff that boils when you pour it out on the ground. I can't resist. Whoa. So even some people in the third row are getting a little bit of liquid nitrogen now. It's just marvelous stuff. But it's just a tiny bit colder than the surface of the sun on this scale. Even the temperature of outer space is just a little bit colder than that. When we first made optical molasses in 1985, it was colder than outer space is by a bigger factor than outer space is compared to the surface of the sun. And that was just the beginning. 700 nanokelvin was how cold we got with laser cooling. And then with evaporative cooling, Bose-Einstein condensation was achieved at 50 nanokelvin. And today, we're at 500 picokelvin, half of 1/1,000,000th of a degree above absolute zero. Look, these are the hot temperatures, outer space and liquid nitrogen. These are the cold temperatures. And we're hoping that sometime in the future we'll be able to take these kinds of experiments into the International Space Station and in microgravity achieve temperatures 1,000 times colder than that. So what's next for all of this? Well, we've already got better clocks. Those better clocks are going to allow us to make fundamental tests of the most fundamental theories of nature. So we heard about string theory. One of the things that's of interest in the Perimeter Institute, one of the things that string theory tries to do is to unify quantum mechanics and gravity. But if you unify quantum mechanics and gravity, something's going to have to change. And some things that Einstein predicted will almost certainly turn out to be wrong. And it may be that super accurate clocks will be one of the ways in which we can test to find out if that's happening. Hasn't happened yet, but it's one of the things we're thinking of. We are using single atoms cooled down by these techniques that I've been telling you about as the qubits for quantum computers, another thing that's of interest here at the Perimeter Institute. What are quantum computers? Well, you all know that your computers that you all have process information in bits. And bits are stored as all sorts of things. On your CDs, they're stored as burned or unburned spots on the disk. In your magnetic memory, it's a place where magnetization is in one direction or the other. In your semiconductor memory, it's a transistor that's turned on or off. These things represent the ones and zeros that form the binary system of calculation in your computer. But there's another way you might think about it. Atoms could be in one of two different quantum states, and those could be the ones and zeros. But the wonderful thing about atoms is they can be in both states at the same time. That can't happen with your CD-ROM. It's either burned or it's not. But an atom can be in one state and it can be in the other state at the same time. And that opens up a whole realm of possibilities that allows quantum computers, if they could be built, to solve problems that are essentially impossible, not just for present computers, but for any computer that we could imagine built according to the architecture of present-day digital computers. Quantum computers could be that powerful. And more things. Perhaps the most exciting things that might be done with cold atoms are things that we haven't even thought of. And it may be that the young people sitting in the first rows are going to be the ones who will think of the most exciting things to do in this field. Well, it's been an exciting 30 years for me. It's been a wonderful pleasure to be with you this evening, and I thank you very much.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.